we'll start. So, welcome everyone to the lecture this evening. It's a great privilege and pleasure to welcome Professor William Kay from Glyndŵr University. William is a very well-known scholar of Pentecostalism in the UK and elsewhere, so it's great to have him here. So on behalf of the Centre for Pentecostal and Charismatic Studies, welcome. This is the first occasional lecture that Walter J. Hollenberger has given his blessing on, so it's a blessed lecture, we hope, and the first one in a series, we hope, over the coming few years on Pentecostal and Charismatic Christianity. And the title of the lecture is Where the Wind Blows, Pentecostal Christians in Hong Kong, Singapore and Malaysia. So without further ado, over to William Kay.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you this evening. And I've got quite a lot to say to you, so I'll probably speak quite fast. I've probably got more material to communicate with you than I can actually get through. I have only met Walter Hollenberger a few times, but I have happy memories of conversations with a great man. He was a professor of mission here in Birmingham for a number of years. Supervised some PhD students who became distinguished people and left a legacy, a literary legacy, behind him. He's Swiss, he's quite an elderly man. Now, I think he's still alive, but not actually in very good health. But I have memories of him, and I have memories of conversation with him. He was what you might call an opinionated person, in the best sense of the word. He had an opinion on pretty much everything that you talked to him about. And he left behind a kind of legacy, which I think is worth just sketching into you with regard to Pentecostal studies. He noted, as you can see, the rapid spread of Pentecostalism in the troubled 20th century. I guess he was one of the first scholars, really, to notice this. He did his PhD in the early 1960s, was then published at the end of the 60s, and so he was ahead of the field. He's multilingual, he's Swiss, speaks I don't know how many languages, but certainly French and German, and so he was able to get to grips with the documentation in a variety of languages, and he noticed the organisational diversity and ecclesial complexity of Pentecostalism from a very early stage. And what he noticed too, particularly, was its oral and narrative theology. He noticed this, that Pentecostalism tended not to be simply, as it were, a book form of Protestantism, but a form of Protestantism that was flexible and varied, and that people would stand up and testify in meetings. And the theology was developed very often from testimony and from narrative, from people's own lives. It was, a theology that came from below rather than from the councils of the church. He noticed its multiple roots, and if you read he wrote a book called Pentecostalism, Origin and Development Worldwide, and he noted the multiple roots of Pentecostalism in that book. He noticed the Wesleyan roots, he noticed the slave religion of the southern states of the United States, their roots, and he noticed other roots of Pentecostalism, holiness roots as well. So his understanding of Pentecostalism is really set the agenda in many ways for Pentecostal studies in the years that followed. People didn't always agree with Hollenberger. Sometimes his views appeared to be, as it were, to the left, to be radical and to be provocative, deliberately so. But I think those who knew him have fond memories. And I look around and I see Richard, I think he was your supervisor for your PhD. So somebody here who remembers his work. And he understood, he noted its ability to adapt to changing cultural conditions, whether in Latin America or in Africa or, as we're talking about now, in Asia. And finally, and this I guess we all understand, he understood the religious experience dimension of Pentecostalism. He noticed that Pentecostalism, as it were, had an implicit emphasis upon experience. So those are, as it were, part of the legacy of Hollenbeger, and I just wanted to note those and sketch those in before proceeding. Now, I want to talk to you about Pentecostalism in Asia, but first I'm just going to talk to you about Pentecostalism in the rest of the world. There are various statistical analyses of Pentecostalism in various parts of the world. I've taken this one from this recent Atlas of Global Christianity, which was produced in association with the centenary of the missionary conference of 1910. So there's 100 years later. And this set of figures is just to give you some context for global Pentecostalism. And you can see here the figures. This is the world population, 1.7 billion, that's 1,000 million. And this is the world population 100 years later. And you can see this enormous population increase in the 100 years. So despite the wars and tragedies of the 20th century, despite the gas chambers and the atomic weapons, the world population grew in the 20th century. And the Christian population of the world, of course these figures are difficult to be absolutely solid on, but you can see something like a third of the world's population in 1910 comes out as Christian, of some kind or another. Not defining that term precisely, but in some way or another, about a third. And by the end of the century, or a century later, also approximately a third. There's a slight slippage there in the Christian population of the world. But generally speaking, the Christian population of the world keeps pace with the dynamic exponential growth of the world's population. And actually, if you look at the way in which the Christian community breaks down, you'll see that if you break it into these three categories, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, and by Orthodox I mean Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, Bulgarian Orthodox, that kind of Orthodox, you'll see that that's the bit that has really declined from 20% of the Christian population to only 12%. And the Catholic numbers have stayed pretty much static. In fact, they've probably increased, which might tell you something about the strength and durability of Roman Catholicism. And then here's the Protestant population, but within this is the Pentecostal group, and you can see a very tiny Pentecostal presence at the beginning of 1910, which grows to something like a third of the Christian population. That's not the world population, that's the Christian population, and that is the case. So you can put it another way: if you calculate the number of Pentecostals as a percentage of the world population, and then you find something like 8 or 9% could be said to be Pentecostal charismatic Christians. This term renewalists is the one that they use. So that's the context for looking at Pentecostalism in Asia. So we move now to Asia particularly, and here I'm using figures from Douglas Jacobson. He's produced a new book about the world's Christians. There, as I say, there are various people who have done this. And you can see that he gives us the population of East Asia as about a third of the world's population. So 2 billion or 2.1 billion, about a third of the global population. That's East Asia. So that excludes India, that excludes Nepal, Tibet. It's East Asia, China, Japan, and then down that the coast. And if you look at these three categories, or perhaps this one is the one we're interested in, something like 55 million Pentecostal charismatic Christians within East Asia. So that shows you that the transfer, the flow of Pentecostal and charismatic Christianity has been substantial. I mean, if I say to you that there are pretty much as many Pentecostal charismatic Christians in East Asia as there are people in the UK, so that gives you some idea. I mean, the population of the UK is now over 60 million, but that gives you some idea of the size of the constituency we're talking about. And so I want to talk about Pentecostalism in East Asia, and I, for a particular research project that I've chosen, I have selected three of the major cities of Asia. I've selected Singapore, I've selected Hong Kong, which is there, and I've selected Kuala Lumpur, which is somewhere there, which is not marked. So I've selected three major cities as it were, a sample of and representative of Asian Christianity. Of course, these are urban areas. I've not chosen rural areas, but I've chosen these three cities. And I've chosen them for a variety of reasons. And I think they are representative of Pentecostalism, as it were, the future of Pentecostalism. That's how I see them, these cities. Each of the cities, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Kuala Lumpur, have quality education systems. They have good education systems, by and large. And what particularly appealed to me is that people there tend to speak English. I would have found it difficult to have learnt a series of other languages. So from my point of view, I could find English speakers in those locations. So possibly, or probably, because of the colonial British interests over in that part of the world, the language of English is spoken. So you'll find people in Singapore that pretty much all speak English. In Hong Kong, it's not quite so common. There are people who prefer, feel happier in Chinese, but English is understood by educated people. And then in Kuala Lumpur, it's actually a generational thing, because the education system continued in English after the British left, and they continued to take A-levels and so on. So there is English spoken there, but more recently there's the Chinese and Malay are more spoken. Now, each of these cities that I've chosen for my research, as I say, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Kuala Lumpur, are similar. They're similar cities in many ways. They have good transport systems. They are cities with good urban transport systems, so people can go in and out to work. They have underground trains, and they're modern, sleek cities. They have shopping malls. They are similar. They are, as it were, cities of the future. They are technological bases in many ways. Singapore used to produce hard disks for computers and so on. And they have religious freedom. I put a question mark there, because religious freedom, there are questions to be asked about exactly how much religious freedom there is, but there's enough religious freedom for Pentecostalism to grow and flourish, as we shall see. Now, I want to talk a little bit about academic engagements with Pentecostalism before I talk about my own particular project. And there have been various academic engagements with Pentecostalism, and one that I pick up is the psychological perspectives. There have been attempts to explore, for example, healing or speaking with tongues among Pentecostals. And there, if you look in the literature, you'll find that there are people who have spent time examining these matters from a psychological perspective. And we can talk about that perhaps later in the questions. And there's some work which I've done and others have done about the personality of Pentecostals and how they might differ or not differ from the general population. In fact, what you discover is that if you look at the data, you'll find that, for example, Anglicans in Britain tend to be more introverted than the general population, whereas Pentecostals are as extroverted as the rest of the population. So Anglicans attract a certain number of introverted people, whereas you won't find that so common in the Pentecostal world. So the psychological literature on Pentecostalism, this goes back to very early studies, about 1910, 1912. And there's even a paper by Freud about 1923 dealing with the case of exorcism, which he reanalyzes. That's a little picture to show you an Asian city. That's just to give you some idea of the bustling life of, I don't know whether that's Hong Kong or Singapore. I think it's probably Hong Kong. It's Hong Kong. It just gives you some feel of a place is absolutely heaving, and people are running about and shopping and working, and it's what it's like. And the churches love it, and the churches love the atmosphere of this kind of busy urban life. Then there are sociological perspectives, and I will say a bit more about these in a moment, but sociologists have also noticed Pentecostalism, and there are sociological analyses of Pentecostalism. And one of the early analyses is that the first Pentecostals came from rural environments, as of course many people have done over the course of this of the 20th century. You understand that by something like 2030, 2025, the majority of people will for the first time on this planet live in cities. And the story of the 20th century is in some ways the story of city building and of migration from the countryside into the great cities that were set up. And so from rural beginnings, people migrate to the anonymity of a big city. And it's suggested within the Pentecostal community, within the church, people find, as it were, the village all over again. People find a community within an anonymous city. So what the Pentecostal church does is it gives you a sense of belonging within the heaving multitudes of these great new cities. There's reference to the work of Max Weber, the German sociologist, who argued and produced, you know, a mass of historical data to suggest that religious movements usually begin with a charismatic founder and then degenerate into a kind of bureaucratic, ossified state. And that it's in the need of these communities is to renew themselves with outbreaks of charismatic activity. And church history can be seen as a kind of series of renewals with outbreaks of charismatic activity or revivalistic activity, and then subsiding into a more bureaucratic phase, and then another renewal. And you can understand that as a way of seeing how church history works. And then a little bit about worldview studies. This might be also better called anthropology, where the notion is that Pentecostalism fits a picture where you have a worldview that accepts the reality of spirits and luck and a spiritual realm. If you like, a worldview which is not an Enlightenment worldview, not a sort of post-Kantian worldview, not the worldview of the rationalistic 17th century, 18th century, but a worldview that comes from somewhere different. And so the worldview of Africa, perhaps, or the worldview of Asia, still is, in a sense, a non-Enlightenment worldview. And so it's arguable Pentecostalism thrives where its worldview, the world where of Pentecostalism with angels and spirits, in some senses matches the worldview of a particular culture. There have been sort of postmodern analyses of Pentecostalism, and one suggestion is that what happens is that there have been studies of why it is that conservative churches tend to grow, whereas liberal churches tend not to grow. And one answer given to this question is that conservative churches offer a sense of answers in a conflicted postmodern world where multiple answers are on offer. But what happens in a conservative church, whether it's evangelical or Pentecostal, there are answers given to questions which enable people to cope with complex moral and other choices. So that within the current worldview, Pentecostalism actually has some kind of advantage. There are feminist accounts of Pentecostalism, and I want to quickly mention those. In countries where the opportunities for female education or female leadership may be limited, Pentecostalism often gives a platform for women, whether it's preaching or prophesying or running part of a church or looking after house groups or groups of house groups. There is a scope for the role of women. And so particularly in macho cultures where women have tended not to be given opportunities, Pentecostalism gives opportunities. And you find, for example, if you read Harvey Cox's account of Fire from Heaven, you'll find an account of him listening to the testimony of a woman in, I think, Brazil, who later becomes a senator or a politician, and kind of taking her first steps in the context of a church. And the other thing that is worth pointing out, and this is again, is that the mega church gives these opportunities. So the big church often gives a raft of opportunities for women, which are attractive to women. And then, too, if a woman wants to bring children up in a moral and safe environment, church may often provide all kinds of opportunities for that, to support kind of family upbringing. So attractive to them. So there are feminist accounts of Pentecostalism which are favourable. There are some that are not favourable, but it's the favourable ones I wanted to mention this evening. And then there are anthropological explanations. There are a number of anthropological studies of Pentecostalism, and you can read Joel Robbins. We can read someone like Simon Coleman, who talks about the anthropology of Pentecostalism. And one of the things that Simon Coleman noted was the way in which Pentecostalism has to some extent ridden on the waves of globalisation, and that Pentecostalism has, as it were, partaken of the cultural flow of globalisation. And if you read his account, Coleman's account of the Livets Ord Church in Sweden, this capacity to harness these global possibilities is something that he notices. And he also notices the kind of prosperity discourse that is in Pentecostalism. So Pentecostalism is, as it were, a faith that meets the needs of aspiring young professionals. I examined a PhD thesis done by a Norwegian a year or so ago, who had examined the Hillsong's Church in London. And the church is attractive to young professionals. Church is not necessarily preaching a doctrine of redemption. It's preaching more a doctrine of empowerment, a doctrine of empowerment in your workplace, rather than the traditional sin and redemption doctrine of earlier Pentecostals. So the Hillsong's account is fits in a situation like Hong Kong or Singapore. And then, of course, there are theological explanations for the growth of Pentecostalism. And I want to mention theological explanations because I do think they're important. They're often overlooked. But of course, if you read Max Weber, came from a Christian background. The term charisma is, of course, from the pages of the New Testament. So implicit within sociological theory are terms that derive directly from a theological basis. And you can see these notions of Pentecost. I won't mention all of them, but you can see here the notion that there are theological explanations for the growth of Pentecostalism. One of the things that I've kind of put here under gifting is that Pentecostals, and this I think if I had to give one reason for the growth of Pentecostal churches, it would be that Pentecostal churches mobilize an entire congregation. If you have a Catholic, a Roman Catholic doctrine of priesthood, then of course only a very special cohort of people are entitled to operate in the priestly function. But if you have a Pentecostal view that the Spirit of God is poured out on all flesh, and the Spirit of God is available to every member of the congregation, that has the effect of mobilizing a whole congregation. And even if not the whole congregation actually avails itself of that possibility, nevertheless, you can see that if you can mobilize 50% of a congregation, you're going to get far more done than if you simply have one professional minister doing all the work. So I would say that kind of one of the secrets of Pentecostalism is its capacity to mobilize large groups of people. Well, these different academic areas lead to a number of research questions. And I have turned these into 12 research questions. So here they are. I know Richard will have seen some of these before. I'm going to go through them. I've got 12. I'm going to quickly go through them and comment on them. So the first one is, as it were, from a psychological, that Pentecostalism succeeds because it promotes integration, stabilization, and actualization of personality. So that notion, that is actually a notion that comes from William James. If you've read William James' Varieties of Religious Experience, you'll see that his notion of conversion is that it takes the personality and takes a divided personality and unites it, integrates it. And that's what the new birth does in the account that William James gives. So this notion that Pentecostalism partakes of that. And so it's worth studying Pentecostal personality psychologically just to see how one can find evidence for that. The second one is the one we've mentioned already, this notion of people finding their communitarian roots in big Pentecostal congregations, finding a sense of belonging and even family within the Pentecostal group, however big it might be. Thirdly, this notion of free-flowing charismatic experience to replace religious formalism. So the notion that, and people often like this sense that Pentecostal service is moving smoothly through and from one thing to another, from testimony to song to worship to prayer, just in a kind of seamless way. People quite enjoy that. Not everybody does, but many people enjoy this kind of kaleidoscopic variety within a service. And though that's one possible reason for, as it were, the growth of Pentecostalism, and that might be seen as a kind of theological rationale. And then this fourth one, and this is really, as it were, a popular charismatic empowerment. Somebody comes to a Pentecostal church, they're converted, they've been a drunkard, they've had various problems, and they find that their life is now purposeful, and they find themselves able to exercise spiritual gifts. They might be praying for the sick, they might be prophesying, they might have other gifts, and they use these gifts within the community and at the service of others. And so Pentecostal congregations, as it were, take people, empower them, and then enable them to function within the Pentecostal and charismatic community. So that's a reason for growth. It makes people, as it were, useful. People who are feckless and aimless. Then I have these other ones. This one I've mentioned already, this notion of a matching worldview, the Pentecostal worldview, matching similar worldviews. That notion. So that would explain Pentecostal growth in some parts of the world, because it wouldn't explain Pentecostal growth in the United States of America, unless we believe, of course, that actually America is not really touched by the Enlightenment. Of course, some of you might think that. But it might explain Pentecostal growth in some parts of the world. Then I've mentioned this before, this notion of preaching to bring certainty in the postmodern world, this sense of providing answers to complicated and difficult questions. And this is the difficulty. Do you want to remain uncertain, or do you want some sense of answers and certainty? That's the question. And most people would prefer to have some answers. And you can see this, of course, if you listen to politicians. Then megachurches. And I was thinking today, the megachurch as the shopping mall. No, the megachurch is the shopping mall. The megachurch is the place that provides something for everybody. You can find in the megachurch everything you want. I remember going with Andrew to visit a megachurch in Texas, and I was quite surprised to discover that they ran, was it three little leagues and a baseball team and something else, and all this stuff was part of what the church offered, particularly Texan form of megachurch perhaps. But the notion of the megachurch as the shopping mall, the notion of the megachurch as having so many different options and ministries, from choir to study groups and prayer groups and missions trips and bookshops and restaurants and so on, all available under the same roof. And this notion of the megachurch as a place where you can find what you need. So a popular kind of Christian life. And then I noticed the cell church. Now, you could argue that the cell church, the notion of the little group, the home group, the small group, the intimate group, This is the building block of the megachurch congregation. And it's arguable that you couldn't have the big group without the little group. In other words, the biggest congregations that came into existence without cell groups, I mean, I don't know how big they are, and you might say that in the 19th century someone like Spurgeon had a big congregation, and perhaps the Crystal Cathedral in the Western United States was very big, but a functioning church, a church where people do things, probably does need small groups to coordinate them and provide people's needs. In fact, it's been said people need to be part of big groups and small groups. And so the megachurch has this capacity. So that's a possible explanation for growth. And you'll appreciate that the cell group, the cell church, functions best in an urban environment where you have high population density. And then engaging in activities that lead to civic and social transformation. Many megachurches do lots of good things, from visiting prisons to helping aged people and so on. Now, those are my hypotheses, and what I decided to do was to try to compare or try to look at ministers in these three different locations to see to what extent their churches might be said to have grown as a result of fulfilling one of those explanatory hypotheses. And I have a questionnaire which some of you will know I feel to be a necessary item on any research project. Not everybody likes questionnaires, but I do. And so I have 930 Pentecostal ministers on a British questionnaire, and I've collected about 300 ministers in these cities. And so the advantage is that I can ask the same questions in the different contexts and compare the answers in the different contexts. So you can make a cross-cultural comparison between Britain and Singapore, or Britain and Hong Kong, or Britain and Malaysia, or Malaysia and Hong Kong, Malaysia and Singapore. So you can make all these different comparisons to see how the ministers differ. And I also interviewed the ministers. And in Singapore, there is Singapore. You can see it's an island connected by a causeway to Malaysia. But it's basically an island, quite a small island. Go across it in, what, an hour? Something like that, less than an hour. And it has 50 Assemblies of God churches. Almost exactly 50 Assemblies of God churches. And so I approached the ministers in those churches and asked them to fill in the questionnaire. And the advantage of that is that, as you'll see, there are actually some Assemblies of God churches in Hong Kong, and some in Britain. So I was able to make comparisons between people in different cultural environments to see how they were different or similar to each other. And I also contacted City Harvest, which is a great big charismatic independent megachurch. It has about 27,000 people in attendance. And then I went to Hong Kong. There's Hong Kong. In some ways, a sister city of Singapore, and again it has about 50 Assemblies of God churches with 50 ministers. So I approached those ministers. So I approached ministers in both those locations. I also did approach people in Kuala Lumpur, but I'm going to leave them out for this evening if you don't mind, because I haven't completed the analysis of them. They're waiting to be analysed. So just to say, I ended up with 125 from Singapore and 86 from Hong Kong. So not all were senior ministers, so different types of minister. Okay, now I'm going to this evening, in the time that I have left, I'm going to talk about these five hypotheses. And I'm going to just show you what my research has found about these different hypotheses, the ones that I've already mentioned with you. So I'm going to look first at charismatic empowerment to see to what extent the data that I collected from Hong Kong and Singapore suggested that charismatic empowerment led to growth. And so here we see slide. And this, remember, these slides are answered by ministers. So 15% of ministers, that's 15% of the 211 that are in this particular analysis. So 15% say that none of their congregation exercise spiritual gifts. But 25%, so a quarter, say that there is a sprinkling of spiritual gifts between 1 and 5% of their congregation exercise spiritual gifts. And of course, what is interesting is about a third say that a third of their congregations exercise spiritual gifts. So you've got quite a spread here, but it allows one to make comparisons between the different churches and the different cultures. But I guess that the main point to notice is that only 15% of Pentecostal churches say that nobody exercises spiritual gifts. Now, probably this is in fact to do with the Pentecostal Holiness Church in Hong Kong, which is really a non-charismatic Pentecostal church. So it's probably they who have caused those figures. But all the rest, you can see quite large numbers. They would expect people in their congregations to exercise spiritual gifts of various kinds. And these might be praying for the sick, they might be prophesying, they might be giving a word of knowledge, or other kinds of things that Pentecostals understand to be charismatic gifts. So there is some indication that charismatic activity is, as it were, of happening in the congregations, according to the ministers. And then we look at the extent to which the churches have grown. And by what percentage has your congregation grown, that should be, in the last year? And you can see that about just 13%, so it's about 1 in 8, say there's been no growth. So these are churches that are static. But most of the churches say they've grown, and some have grown absolutely astonishingly. Of course, what may have happened is that the ones that have grown have taken people from the ones that haven't grown. And that does happen as transfer. So the mega churches may have, as it were, captured some people from the smaller churches, and that is a phenomenon both in Singapore and in Hong Kong, where the mega churches, as it were, hoover up the people, and the smaller churches find it difficult to compete. So that is an occurrence, and it's one of the difficulties that one has. But anyway, just to say, you can see that there is growth. Now, if we look at the size of the congregations, I'll quickly mention that before. This is this is Singapore. This is Trinity at Paya Lebar in Singapore. You can't really get any idea of the size of this, but I mean it is a substantial complex here, with a college inside it as well as about 6 auditoriums of different sizes. I mean this room here would be one of the smaller auditoriums, but they run a Tamil service and they run a service for Burmese people and for Filipino people, all in rooms this size or bigger. And then the main congregation is about 6,000 people. And this is another one. This is City Harvest. This is the independent one. Now, this is the size of the church, and you can just see a quarter of ministers had at least 450 people in their Sunday morning congregation. So congregations, by and large, are quite substantial. Now, what is the evidence for the hypotheses? Well, here you can see, I looked to see what the correlation was between the number of people in a congregation exercising spiritual gifts and church growth. So I wanted to discover whether those congregations that had a lot of people exercising spiritual gifts were also the congregations that were growing. So you could argue that congregations that are exercising spiritual gifts are frightening to people, and they put people off, and that they stay away. Or you could argue the opposite, that congregations that exercise spiritual gifts are attractive to people and draw people in. So I'm testing to see what the answer is. And what I discover is that there is, in both Singapore and in Hong Kong, I do a chi-square for these, I find that there is a significant connection between the percentage of people exercising spiritual gifts and church growth. So I'm finding correlational evidence that there is a connection between the charismatic activity of the church and its growth. So I can suggest to you that it's not that charismatic gifts frighten people off, but rather it's actually a means by which churches grow. And you can see that this matches the results of Margaret Paloma, and it matches my own results in the UK. So I'm beginning to suggest to you that there is, despite cultural differences between different parts of the world, North America, the UK, and Hong Kong and Singapore, you can find similar correlations at work. So I want to suggest to you that there may be, as it were, a culturally irreducible model. There may be, as it were, a core model to explain Pentecostal growth that seems to operate in several cultures, not just one culture, but several cultures. So I want to suggest to you that perhaps the dynamics of church growth are similar in different cultures. That's, as it were, a thesis I want to advance to you. Well, let's go on to the next one. What time have I? How much time have I got?
Got another 10 minutes.
Right, I'll rush through. So, what about civic roots? Well, look, just here's this is a question. I think this is asked of ministers. How important is a sense of belonging, community, reminding your roots? And you can see the figures are high. This one particularly, people want to belong to their church, have a sense of community. So although the megachurch is mega, I mean the megachurch is a crowd, nevertheless there is a sense of belonging. That's the astonishing thing about it. It's not like going to a sort of, you know, London in the rush hour and all the people milling about and nobody knowing each other. It's a case of going in a group where you know people. As I say, it's more like a village. It's more like a town. It's a place where you say hello to people you know. You know their names, their faces, their spouses and so on. You know something about them and their family and their father and their uncle and so on. And so it's a case of belonging. And however, there is no sense of correlation between belonging and church growth. So I couldn't find that led to church growth. I found it important, but it didn't make churches grow. And here, again, just a little bit more data. I like the friendship at my church. 99% agree. My church supports family life. So this is what really the churches are. That's why they're attractive to people. And then my church should be more involved in family life. Well, not everybody says yes, but maybe that's because they think it's already involved in family life. What about empowering women? Now, I've got a lot of figures here, and I won't go through them all, but just look at this one here. I've put some of the ones I want to comment on in red. 93%. Now, these are ministers who are both male and female. Women should have the same opportunities for ministry as men. 93% agree. So you've got overwhelming yes for that. So the notion that these churches are really egalitarian, or theoretically egalitarian, as far as women are concerned. And you can work it the other way. If you say, women should not preside over Holy Communion, then 90% disagree. So you can see that there is a strong sense in these Asian cultures that women should have an opportunity to function within churches. That's quite clear. On the other hand, 88% think women should obey their husbands. Now, so on the one hand, there's huge opportunities for women, but on the other hand, there's a kind of traditional sense of marriage. I say traditional, depends how traditional you are, but you can see the sense is that this is not quite sort of post-feminist egalitarianism. This is something else. So there's a strong sense of the importance of marriage and order in the home, but that goes alongside opportunity in the church. And then just to follow these up, great support for women preaching. So, you know, people disagree that women should not exercise a preaching ministry. Also, they agree that women should. So the people are quite happy to listen to women preaching. They have no worry. 95% happy about that. And exercising spiritual gifts, again, huge, huge group saying yes to that. So the expectation is that women will preach, preside over communion, and exercise spiritual gifts. So a strong sense of female participation and, as it were, social empowerment. And then if you correlate these figures with the question about spiritual gifts in the congregation and church growth, you find these correlations. Now, I'm going to comment just on a few of them. So there's a correlation here between women should not preside over Holy Communion and church growth, and it's a negative correlation, meaning that if you say that women should not preside over Holy Communion, you don't get much church growth. But if you say women should preside over Holy Communion, you do get church growth. So in other words, church growth occurs where women have an opportunity to function in that way. And this is probably the biggest correlation that I found, 2.7. And you can see where women can exercise spiritual gifts, then you actually find spiritual gifts exercised and you find church growth, because that's a church growth one. So, in other words, part of the secret for church growth is the fact that women are involved, active, contributing, participating in the process of the church. So, as far as I'm concerned, the empowerment of women leads to not only spiritual gifts within the congregation, but church growth. Let me hurry through a bit about cell structures. I won't say a great about this. It turns out that there are lots of sort of finer distinctions made about cell churches, including some churches are not cell churches, but they have cells. So you have to quite understand precisely how the pastor understands cell churches. And I just found some significant correlation between whether they're cells and spiritual gifts, but not between cells and growth. So it seems that spiritual gifts are encouraged within the cell rather than church growth occurs through the cell. What about health and prosperity? And here I just got a number of figures to show you. Two-thirds believe that God desires material prosperity of the church. So this is a gospel, this is a belief of that really God wants us to prosper. And that's very understandable. I think for too long, churches often believe the opposite. But notice this 55%, these two figures are slightly different. So they don't agree that all Christians should experience material prosperity, but the church as a whole should experience prosperity. And then strong belief in healing, 98-95%. So strong belief in healing and a slightly less strong belief in prosperity. Now, I you can just see these figures, but God desires prosperity, 68% agree. And this is healing in the atonement. Notice this one here. My church teaches me how to succeed in the world of work. Strong engagement with, as it were, the secular marketplace. The church helps me in the world of work. The church helps me in my business. The church helps me to do what I have to do to earn my living. So the kind of entrepreneurial sense that the church is enabling me to succeed in the busy life of Singapore. I'm going to just quickly rush through to the end now. I produced 12 hypotheses, and I found support for most of them, and the question is, how should they be rated? And that's a question I'm still working on. I did interview pastors, and I just want to say very quickly that not all Pentecostal churches in these cities are the same. For example, I was really quite surprised to discover in one church a very strong belief in Messianic Judaism and a strong belief that Christians should take part in the Feast of Tabernacles and so on and go to Jerusalem and give money to the poor saints of Jerusalem. Quite surprised to discover that. Hadn't expected that. Likewise, there are quite clear differences between different Pentecostal churches. Some Pentecostal churches much more in the Assemblies of God style of voting and a group of people in a congregation as a whole making a decision, and others apostolic directives are coming down from above. And you find both democratic Pentecostal churches and non-democratic Pentecostal churches. One of the big differences that occur. And you find both kinds of churches in both Singapore and Hong Kong. And then a little bit about friendship evangelism. And I would say that the old Pentecostal churches are much more, as it were, relaxed. And the new apostolic churches are much more disciplined and in a sense, controlling. Which leads me to my final slide, which is just to suggest to you that there may be comparisons that you can draw between Pentecostals in what you might call a Western culture. Although this is also a Western culture. I mean, Asian culture is Western. I mean, it's certainly not just Confucian. And you can see that there are similarities in the two cultures. So I end my lecture by suggesting to you that, in fact, that there are, as I said to you earlier, similar dynamics which underlie the growth of Pentecostal churches in East and West. And yet there is more to be discovered. And with that, I thank you. Right.